You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Coldale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. Welcome back, listeners, to part two of the Mixenden Treasure with special guest John Billingsley. We're going to pick up now at the beginning of the actual treasure hunt itself. The plot begins to take shape. If we can narrow down the timestamp to when the actual expedition was taking place.
It seems that by some means they decided to make the attempt on or around Candlemas, which is February the 2nd.
Is this 1510?
This is 1510, yeah. Now, there are curiosities about that because, as you know, it's February, it's cold, it's the days are short, and they would have had to go from Bingley across to Mixenden, deal with the demon, and carry a lot of treasure back to Bingley at night, presumably. You kind of wonder, maybe the darkness was seen as a positive. But we know what it's like in February on the moors. It's cold, it's muddy, it's dark, it's miserable. So it does seem counterintuitive, but maybe there's another reason. Maybe other people were beginning to hear rumours of their attempt. So they went for that date, and then they started gathering all sorts of equipment. And the equipment that we have a list of, this is also one of the confusions, because it seems they made two attempts. The equipment may have been slightly different in between them, but right. They at some point they wanted alarmin made. This may have been for the second attempt. Alarmin is basically a magical medallion inscribed with sigils, you know, that's magical signs, inscribed with sigils and maybe some lettering, which enabled you to make contact and converse with the spirit. They had a magic circle, and we shouldn't maybe see this as a big circle of material, but a ring of material. But it's made of virgin parchment, which I mentioned before, the in from the first calf. And they wanted a scepter. That seems to have been used in the Mixenden attempt. They had a sprinkle, which is a holy water sprinkler. They had salt, which you need for making the holy water, of course, and a thurible, which is an incense censer. And that would have been used along with the holy water, the sprinkle, to cleanse the working magic circle. They had frankincense for the incense. They had books, probably the mass book and probably a grimoire of some kind. They had torches. And they had singing breads, which I just love that term. And what that is, it's the old word for communion wafers.
Okay.
Now, a lot hinges on those, because if they had consecrated them for use, and how they would have used them would have been, if the demon got a little bit troublesome, they would have brought out the communion wafers and cut them down to size, as it were, you know, made them a bit more amenable. But if you consecrate it for a demonic association, that would have invoked charges of heresy.
Yeah, that's definitely crossing over, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. So they had them, but they probably weren't consecrated. At least if they were, they weren't saying.
Yeah. They have this swag of stuff and they get it out. You can see how some of the conspirators might be slightly terrified by seeing all these, this ritual paraphernalia brought out and think, sure, we're not breaking any laws here.
Well, if you think, you know, what do you need? This circle is probably about 21 feet. This ring is probably about 21 feet across. And somebody,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a stage, essentially. A magic circle is a stage for activity by either magicians or demons.
So if we're talking like virgin parchments, they'd have to be sewn together. I mean, you'd have to have more than one, wouldn't you? Calves are not that big.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Oh, God. Grim.
At some point, somebody would surely have said, what's this circle for
Yeah.
then? Oh, well, that's where the demon's going to appear. Demon.
Yeah. They travelled to Otswell's house in Bingley, didn't they? That's where they all met up.
Yeah.
And now that we've just mentioned this, Wilson actually blundered in on the priests, checking that they had
Yeah.
everything.
There's the first glimmer there that they obviously went to this room and they probably said to the others, we're just, going to do some private stuff. Obviously, they thought that we're the magicians, we need to know about this stuff. The others don't need to know. Wilson may have thought, I do need to know. Or you may just think, this is my house, I work here. So, whatever happened, he came into it, and that's possibly when he became aware of the level of magical involvement that was going to be required. It may be that the ordinary commoners didn't quite know that at that time.
So, because of the blurred boundaries between magic and spirits and Christianity and God, they are teetering on the edge of walking into dodgy territory in terms of what they were doing, aren't they?
Definitely potentially transgressive.
Yeah. The priests counseled the others that they should be purified at mass before they all took off. That must have been something else that would have worried them.
No, I don't think it would have worried the ordinary people,
Oh,
commoners
okay.
so much. I think they would have thought to get an extra layer of protection, of holy protection, would be useful for this. The only person it seemed to worry was John Stewart. And he said, no, he's not going to do that. He's not going to get for a mass. He said he had a cold, but he also, other times, said, well, it doesn't make any difference necessarily. He said, but if you're going to deal with magic and you've just been through a mass, then that is going to compromise your relationship with the demon. So he said, so I don't want to do that. So it's two understandings of magic that is beginning to show up here. And I'll mention this while we're here because I don't know where else it would fit in. John Stewart also seemed to have maybe a different idea of the magic circle. And in the Middle Ages, we think of the magic circle today, thanks to Hammer horror films and so on, as the magicians put themselves inside the circle while all hell breaks loose outside. Yeah, so the magicians are protected, but that's not the only way of seeing a magic circle. And in the Middle Ages, a contrary view was held that a magic circle was constructed as a stage for the demonic activity to appear. So the magicians were outside doing ritual and everything should be safe inside. So we need to be careful not just to read our modern understanding into this. So John Stewart was obviously one of those who thought by proper ritual you could go in and out of the circle, but most particularly the circle itself was where you'll speak to, in this case, Belfaris.
Yes, it's interesting how that's flipped on its head, isn't it?
It is.
So they met at Otwell's house in Bingley around Candlemas. They've got all the ritual stuff that they need. They've had mass, apart from Steward. They set out. You say they seem to be aiming for a sunset meeting at a cross west of Soul Hill.
Yeah.
What happened, the expedition?
If you've got a bunch of blokes carrying things like scepters, holy water sprinklers, incense burners, all setting off into the outwoods, it would have raised suspicions. So they set off from different places in Bingley. and in smaller groups.
And they divided the...
They divided the equipment and stuff. But where they gather is a place called Wilston Lee, which we interpret as Lee Farm, now known as Lee Farm Wilston. But by the time they got there, a mist was beginning to form. And mentioned in the equipment is something called a dial with a neld, which T.W. Hansen, the Halifax antiquarian, interpreted as a mariner's compass. And I think he's probably right in that. They probably had a compass with them, and they were still confident of getting through to Mixendale. So off they went, and they went on over the hills. Bear in mind, Bingley to Mixen is about 9 miles. It's not that far, actually. But it was in the mist, and they came to a place called Cochan, which is now Clayton Heights. Cochan was the medieval and early modern name for it. And the name is fascinating because T.H. Smith, the place names expert, comments that this is probably a humorous nickname. 500 years ago, it would have been a miserable spot. It's on top of a hill. It's windblown. A devil of evil. It's a bit of a joke, a devil of a job. It would have been a hard place to make a living. But Smith reckons the name Cochan derives from cocaine.
Oh.
This is not white powder we're talking about. We're talking about the medieval mythical land of cocaine, where the streets are paved with gold, where the living is easy. So in other words, it was a medieval practical joke on people living in really difficult circumstances. Are they living cocaine, you know?
Were we talking Queensbury, Bradford?
Yeah, just beyond Queensbury. And it's the first intimation of a kind of a trickster sensation coming into this whole story. They've been drawn astray by the mist, and they'd ended up having thought that they were going to find a fortune by which they would live in luxury, easy living for the rest of their lives. They find themselves in a place named after that, but way off the track.
So they've lost their way, basically.
They've lost their way. They keep going, and they find themselves at a place called Mickle Moss, which is nowadays Mountain near Queensbury.
Okay.
But Mickle Moss, well, I'll tell you about that in a second, but on Mickle Moss, there was a cross. It wasn't the right one. And now I'll tell you what Mickle Moss means. It means the great bog. So imagine these people standing together in fog on a cold February afternoon, stranded, lost in the great bog. Spirits must have begun to waver. They found this fellow who said, "Oh, I know the cross you're looking for." So they gave him tuppence. Some of the company then went back to Cochan because they were hungry and they were bored and irritated. And a couple of them went off with this local chap to find the Soil Hill cross. This local chap also got lost. When that happened, they all gave up. They went back to Cochan. They found that their friends had headed back to Bingley. So they all went back to Bingley. Only two people made it to Soil Hill Cross. These two had gone back, Greenwood and Wood, had gone back to Heptonstall to have dinner with Richard's father and Edmund. They were the only ones that made it there.
On the same night?
On the allotted time, yeah.
But didn't find the treasure.
Yeah. So everybody went back to Bingley in poor temper. The Greenwoods went back there. And obviously at some point they discussed, what do we do now? Now we should say that if they had made it to the mound where the treasure was, in order to get past the demon, they were going to invoke spirit called Belfaris. That's the one I mentioned that could be invoked without fear of compromising your Christianity. And a noble spirit. Well, back in Bingley, Wilkinson had an idea. You thought, well, why didn't you think of that before? That Belfaris actually could be invoked from anywhere. because he would also, being a good friendly spirit, had the ability to bring the treasure to you wherever you were. This is really fishy by this point, isn't it? So he sort of says, well, tell you what, we'll go to Harden Wood tomorrow morning. We'll get there and we'll invoke Belfaris and get him to bring it to us. So they all agreed on that and went to bed, chuntering probably. The next day they went to Harden Wood. Wilkinson, who had suggested this idea, didn't turn up. Tempers were not improved. They discussed, okay, what now?
Edmund Greenwood, he had something to say, didn't he? Which is it's pivotal, isn't it?
Yeah. Edmund, who's the father of Richard, he knew of the three people who'd attempted this grab and hadn't managed it. He suggested to Richardson and Jameson that it really wasn't a well-starred idea anyway, and you should maybe think of it another time. He suggested that they leave the magic circle with him, which of course they weren't very happy with.
No.
They thought he was beginning to take over.
His quote was, "Sir, you seem a gentleman, and I advise you not to proceed with this matter. There have already been wise men and well learned after the treasure, and they could not get it." And then he says, "And you will just become the talk of the world."
That's right.
It's almost
Yeah.
prophetic, isn't it?
I think they already were rumors going around.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they may have made a sudden decision to go for it on Candlemas. Too many people are speaking of it. So the company continued talking about it. And at that point, the ex-Lord Mayor, Jameson, kind of stepped in and said, you know what? When we get this treasure, it's going to be enough to ransom a king. So if all you commoner types and yeomen suddenly get a share of that, it's going to look really weird, isn't it? So what I suggest is that we give you 20 guineas each or something. And I'll take the rest because, as a gentleman and already rich, a rich merchant, Lord Mayor, and all of that, it won't look so strange. How does that sound? And you can imagine how that sounded. There was obviously an argument.
Wilson particularly wasn't happy, was he?
Well, obviously, no. The sparks of democracy were flaring up at this time.
Yeah.
Jameson didn't like it one bit. So he finally decided to invoke his status and says, right, okay. Obviously, we haven't actually done this thing yet. So we haven't broken any laws, but we are plotting. And I'm going to take all your names and I'm going to tell the king about it, unless you do my will, presumably. And at that point, obviously, everything gets worse and they break up, total dissension.
In the wood.
Yeah, they go back to Bingley, pack up their things, and leave. And that's the end of what my reconstruction suggests is the first of two, which the other antiquarian attempts think that was only there was only one.
So it was a failed attempt, basically, very dispiriting for them. But that wasn't the end of it, was it? What happened next?
You have kind of had to wonder whether it may possibly have been in the minds of the gentleman anyway, given Jameson's outburst about separating the money. But it would seem that Richardson, Wilkinson, and Jameson decided to go ahead and to ditch John Stuart because they didn't seem to have any further faith in him, either as a magic worker or as a helper. For what reason we don't know, but there were arrangements made which seemed to involve acquiring a room with windows in each of the cardinal directions, and for these participants to make a larmen. And this is where the larmen seems to come in. And in that room, with the appropriate ritual conditions. And the larmen was to be inscribed with the name Oberion. And this is important. Oberon, everybody knows Oberon in Shakespeare. But we might think Shakespeare made it up, but he didn't, because Oberon was already known in the Middle Ages as a king of the fairies, as a powerful fairy personality. And magicians have been working with him for 200-300 years, even before Shakespeare came along. So Oberion is Oberon. Now, Oberon has got pedigree. And there's a 13th century French romance called Huon of Bordeaux, if I remember rightly, which gives us an inkling of how Oberon was seen. Basically, Huon of Bordeaux talks about how Huon goes off to meet Oberon, and he is advised by a Christian hermit he meets, says, well, you'll meet Oberon and he'll come up to you and engage you in a friendly manner, but don't be tempted, don't speak to him, you know, because if you do, he will bring storms and tempests and all kinds of things. Huon goes off, Oberon comes to meet him, tries to strike up conversation. Huon ignores him. Oberon is not best pleased, gets the storms and so on, and the bad weather. But then he makes another attempt, and this time Huon looks at his face and says, well, okay, he's got wonky shoulders. You know, this is actually said in the description, but he's got an angelic face. And he was about the size of a small child. So he finally decides to talk to Oberon and engage him. And they have a lovely chat, basically, and all the storms cease. And Huon ends up as king of Fairyland, which ticks off King Arthur, because he reckoned he had a good good chance of that role.
This is
a medieval romance.
Yes, right. Okay. Yeah.
So in this second attempt, they're addressing Oberon.
In the hope that he will be friendly and helpful.
Well, yes, because what had happened in the first attempt was that they shouldn't have got lost, but they did. They got lost by a sequence of bad weather events. And Oberon was already well known in the magical milieu of that time. So his tendency to bring bad weather, if you displeased him, would have been known. So I think these three had thought, well, given what happened, sounds like Oberon's at work, which must mean this is fairy treasure. And if we want to get fairy treasure, we'd better speak to Oberon himself.
It seems amazing that you've got priests thinking this way, doesn't it? Nowadays
it does, but back in the 17th century, when you had the Reverend Thomas Kirk writing The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns and Fairies, because he's had such extensive dealings with fairy kind in Scotland, that he writes a whole description of their society and how they organize themselves. You realize, you know, that our modern conceptions are quite far from what was actually going on. So they decide that they'll make an attempt with this Laman, with Oberon, and they'll speak politely, respectfully to Oberon, which is all he asks in the first place.
This is Jameson, Richardson, Wilkinson, and also is Greenwood involved at this point or not?
Probably yes, he would have been. This is the priests, yeah, and the mayor, all those with status, in other words,
yeah.
They ditch the commoners. Oberon is known to get a bit moody if he's not treated with respect, but fairies are also known to dislike duplicity and greed. Now, the first attempt on the treasure was certainly greed. There was also duplicity going on quite clearly within the group between the status levels. So there were various reasons why that group of people may have thought, ah, this sounds like we've offended the fairy realm. Now we have to start working with it. Makes sense. They made the Lamen. Whether they got any further, we don't know, because somebody blew the whistle.
They had a meeting, I think you say,
Yeah.
at Chaplin Addingham.
This is where the party came in, but I think they may have drunk too much wine. And Wilkinson at some point made the comment that we could acquire the treasure, but it might entail the loss of a Christian soul, which can be interpreted as sacrifice, death, or it could just be interpreted when you think of Huon, for instance, he was a Christian soul who became king of the fairies. It could just have meant that he was lost to Christendom but did okay. But anyway, I think that scared at least one of the priests at that party, and I suspect it was Thomas Banks who blew the whistle. It went to the Archbishop and said, by the way, you've got some priests who are about to call up the King of the Fairies, and we think you ought to look into it. Here are their names.
We should also maybe point out that in those days, when they talk about a loss of a Christian soul, quite often what they would do would almost try and trick the spirits. They would christen an animal. It's not nice by our standards, but they'd christen an animal and say a chicken and then sacrifice the chicken and say, "Here's your Christian soul."
This is in folk tales all over the place. The building of Devil's Bridge in Kirkby Lonsdale, for instance, that was built by the devil after making an exchange with a lady whose livestock was on the other side of the gorge. And he said, I'll build it for you in exchange for the first soul to cross the bridge. So when the morning came, the bridge was there, brand spanking new, and she had this deal to honor. Instead of walking over herself, she sent her dog through a lump of food over the bridge, and the dog went after it, and that was the loss of the soul. You know, it didn't ask for it to be a Christian soul, particularly, just asked for a sacrifice. So this was quite common. Belfares wasn't going to demand a soul, but you never knew, maybe with Oberon.
So after we think Henry Bank has dobbed them in, what happens then in terms of the investigation and punishment?
They were called in to the court May 5th, 1510, Archiepiscopal Court at York.
Right.
And, you know, that would have just been a small room, basically, with the scribe and probably a few clerics asking questions, trying to make some kind of sense of it. And once they'd questioned them all, the punishment was doled out. There was never really any question of them having been found innocent. This was a matter of common knowledge, it would seem, by that time. The conspirators say, well, you know, people seem to know what's going on. And the idea of the court would be to say, just how guilty are you and of what exactly? Is it something we need to excommunicate you for? You know, they couldn't prescribe capital punishment. You know, a church court was not
Civil court.
civil court, yeah. But they could elevate it to a civil court if there was cause. You've probably got my chapter open in front of you there, which I don't. They were all given the penance to do.
Yes, they were tried, and I think, like you said at the top of the episode, the main concern is whether or not they'd committed heresy. That was the main concern.
And also sorcery.
And sorcery. So June 11th, all except John Steward were ordered to attend York Minster at around 10 a.m., where they were chastised. Now,
I found the page now.
yeah.
Yeah, they were chastised. It's great kind of euphemism for whipped. And so they were whipped around York, basically. How exactly they were whipped, I'm not sure, but amongst the places where they were whipped were various churches. Also, Witmawatma Gate. Now, if you read a lot of local histories and local guides about Witmawatma Gate, the guides will always say, this doesn't mean there was whipping going on. Oh, yes, there was. Yeah, we've got documentary evidence of them.
This was like a procession to humiliate them, basically. They were barefoot and bareheaded, which for priests would be humiliating. And they had to carry banners with characters and figures upon them. Is that's right, isn't it?
That's what it said in the original article we found. Because of course this is not part of the court transcripts now. It's just a report of the punishment that was written down for them. So yes, distance would have been probably about a kilometre just over of frequent whippings and.
Yeah, and this was, I suppose, in a way, a warning to the population in general that you don't do this.
It's equivalent, I suppose, to some regimes around the world where they parade criminals with a banner around the neck saying what they'd done. So this lot, Jameson had to carry a scepter with him. Otwell had to carry a lighted torch. Wilson carried the water sprinkler. And Wood was carrying the thurible, the incense centre. Knowles was carrying a torch and salt. And we're not sure what the others were carrying. So, and that was only the first stage. And then they had to appear at Bingley later that month in the marketplace. Steward was partially excommunicated until the August of that year. As long as he completed his full penance.
What exactly is excommunication, just for?
Excommunication means you are cut off from engagement in the rites of the church and from full protection of God, basically.
Right.
So that if you did happen to die, St. Peter wouldn't be seeing you. I suppose that's
Your
one
name's
way of.
not on the list. You're not
Yeah,
coming
that's right.
in.
And it's a bit like Santa Claus, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he was a bit naughty and nice. And what Stuart had to do was to go to on market days to York and Knaresborough to carry his banner. And on two Saturdays around churches at Knaresborough, Ripon, and Doncaster. So Stuart over the next 2 3 months would have been getting in his full complement of 10,000 steps a day for sure. Now he's got quite a lot of distance to cover and to stand in public shame in these places. He got it worse because he'd already been warned about
Okay,
his
right, yeah.
activities. Yeah. So a couple of centuries later. Yeah, a century and a half later, this would have been illegal. In fact, even later that century, Henry would have brought in the first of the witchcraft statutes, which forbade treasure hunting. So they just got in with 30 years to spare before it would have been a civil offence.
So that was the end of it, basically, as far as they were concerned.
It's the end of us of what we know about it.
Yeah.
For instance, the court doesn't appear to have been aware that there may have been two attempts, and that second Larmin making might have been part of a separate attempt. I might be wrong in my reconstruction, but this just seems to make most sense to me. Then the question is, what happened to the rest of the stuff? What did happen to that magic circle? Because it was last seen in the possession of Jameson and Richardson in York. Yeah. Did they make it? They made the Larmen. When the fuss was down, did they go back to Mixenden and have another go? Did they find it? Did they get rich? There's nothing that I've seen which says, and Jameson suddenly became very rich before he died in 1527. So, what did they do? We don't know. Did they just keep their heads down? What happened? Implicitly, is the Mixenden treasure still there?
Yeah.
Vanished from our sight now because it caused so much trouble. It was talked about, it was known in the area. In the 18th century, you had a nonconformist minister get very excited when, on the grounds of Mount Zion Chapel, which was being built, they dug up an urn, and he thought this might be the gold of the Mixenden treasure. And then, when I was doing the research for this in the 90s and 2000s, I talked to several people who'd grown up in Mixenden, and they said, as boys, they were always digging up here and there, trying to find it. And an old library colleague of mine called Kathleen told me that she'd grown up at Fold Farm on the edge of Illingworth and Mixenden. And there was a low stone wall in the garden there. She was always told that there was a treasure buried in that wall, but she hadn't to think of getting it because then a great demon would come out and get her. And that would have been late 40s or early 50s.
It persisted.
Yeah.
It survived into modern folklore, basically. Talking about the history of it, the apparent need for the treasure to be protected by fairies and demons, the existence of treasure and the hunt for treasure seems to bring out the most nefarious qualities in humans.
Yes, doesn't it?
And the need for people to feel that it's protected in some way to ward against that.
Yeah.
Because it's greed, basically, isn't it? And
It is.
duplicity.
Yeah. Still happens today with oil.
Yes.
You
Yeah.
know, so,
Do you want to say a little bit more on the fairy perspective?
there are a couple of aspects of the Mixenden treasure when you're looking at hindsight, which really appeal to me in the sense that does anything really change? One is the class issue that was expressed, the class warfare which developed after the failure of the first one. Second one is this idea of being led astray by the fairies. Now, that's an idea called being pixie led in Cornwall, where it's really quite a common feature of folklore, but it's not just in Cornwall, it's known everywhere. You can be in a landscape that you know well, or you've no reason to get lost in it, and suddenly you're completely awry. You don't know where you are. Your sense of place has been disrupted. That's a common motif in fairy folklore, and being sent adrift by poor weather is also part of that same area of folklore. And the Mixenden treasure adventure is a classic example, I would say, of the kind of thing that might happen to you if you mess with the fairies. It would have been known that before, but you know, it's obviously not proof, but it's so close a parallel that you can see that back in those days, it would have loomed very large in their consciousness. You know, we've been sent really astray. And why? Because we should know where we are. How could it happen? And because of the way it happened, they would have been inclined to think fairy, some kind of non-mundane interference.
I think these sort of phenomenon, for them to be even have a term, say pixie led, it must be within people's experience. Through time, to have this sensation for whatever reason you want to attribute it to, but it's definitely there, isn't it?
Yeah, and the usual medicinal scientific explanations don't always work, particularly not when they're shared experiences.
Yes.
What can I say? At this point, you have to take people's testimony at face value, not impose your own materialist preconceptions
Yes.
of the world onto it. You may not believe in fairies, you may find them a strange thing to believe, you may not believe in witches and magic and all of that. You may think, oh no, we don't do that. But people did in those days, and we have to respect them for that. We have to respect that they report what they experience. And it's not up to us to gainsay that experience.
Otherwise, we can't fully understand them, can we?
Not at all.
It's been fascinating, John.
Thank you, Joe, for asking great questions as ever. You're really good.
Oh, thank you for coming on.
Are you taking your spade up to Mixenden next week?
I don't think so.
No.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, produced and presented by Jill Carpington. And join us next time for the return of weird Calderdale author Paul Weatherhead, where he and I will be discussing the curious history of Tom Bell.